Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to Psycho Killer. I'm Simon Ford, a writer and journalist.
I'm Jack Morrell. I was a major crime detective for 30 years, and now I'm Psycho Killer's law enforcement expert.
And I'm Pip Watts. I'm a TV reporter and radio presenter, and I'm fascinated by the psychology that makes our most evil criminals tick.
This is the third episode in our series about familial DNA, looking at how the genetic fingerprint of a loved one helped catch the killer in the family.
Or as I like to call it, you can choose your friends, but not your relations.
Episode 1 exposed Joseph DeAngelo Jr., the Golden State Killer. DeAngelo Jr. terrorized California in the 70s and 80s. This rogue cop committed at least 13 murders, 50 rapes, and 120 burglaries.
In episode 2, we stared into the dark heart of Paul Hutchinson, who raped and strangled 16-year-old Colette Arum near Nottingham, dumping her naked body in a field.
This time, our investigators are heading to the other side of the world, and a case that shocked Australia. As a woman and a mother myself, it really resonates with me. So let's get straight into it. It's time to head to the dark side.
We've landed at Cooktown in far northern Queensland, a four-hour drive from Cairns on State Route 81. Cooktown gets its name from Captain James Cook, the great British explorer credited with discovering Australia. Here, the Endeavour River flows into the ocean. The river is named after Cook's ship, which he beached here for repairs in 1770. With a population of about 4,000, Cooktown is one of the last settlements before you reach the very tip of the continent. Beyond lies the Torres Strait and Papua New Guinea. It's a laid-back kind of place, popular with tourists who stop off to marvel at the magical sunsets while sinking a cold beer outside the local pub. You might also catch a glimpse of one of Cooktown's most infamous inhabitants, the giant Australian saltwater crocodile. They are why you can't buy a surfboard in Cooktown.
In August 2017, in one of these croc-infested rivers, locals found the body of 42-year-old Donna Steele. She'd been in the water for several days. It was apparent Donna had been abducted, but the cause of her death was unclear. The pathologist recorded it as a combination of strangulation, suffocation, and drowning. Crucially, there was some twine discarded near the scene, twine that had been used to tie her up. It was from the twine that the police found DNA from someone other than Donna herself. But whose DNA was it?
The Queensland Police timeline shows that the murder took 7 months to solve. Here's a snapshot from it. Around midday on August 2nd, 2017, Donna Louise Steele was last seen in Cooktown. Her husband reported her missing the following day. Despite a police search and press appeals, Donna's body wasn't found until 3 days later, on August the 6th. In February 2018, Police Minister Mark Ryan announced a $250,000 reward for information leading to the identification and conviction of the person or people responsible for the murder of Donna Steele. In March 2018, the police announced, new information is provided to police regarding Donna Steele's death and confirms publicly the belief that the person responsible for murdering Donna wasn't from Cooktown.
Is this a sign that they're onto him then, when they've got DNA and they start to eliminate suspects?
Correct. And within a day or so, someone got a knock at their door.
Police search warrant, open the door!
Aha, the famous 6 o'clock knock.
Police attended a McComb Street address in Moorabool and arrested a 25-year-old man. A few days later, a 25-year-old man appeared at Cairns Magistrate Court, charged with murder, misconduct with a corpse by interfering, and entering a dwelling with intent.
So, Pip, what was that new information that led to this arrest?
Well, after a public appeal in Cooktown, around 200 people had voluntarily provided their DNA to assist the investigation. The samples were submitted and police ran a familial search. There was a match with the killer's own mother. Detective Sergeant Scott McGrath told SBS News Network in Australia,
"We went down a path of collecting DNA samples from the wider community in Cooktown. The intention was to firstly eliminate all the males of Cooktown from that DNA profile that we found on the riverbank, but also putting together a database that could be added to the national database for the purposes of a familial comparison. There was quite a bit of motivation on the part of the Cooktown community to have the crime solved. There was a perception there was a killer in the community whose identity was unknown, so by and large, the majority of the Cooktown community were prepared to supply their DNA voluntarily."
Results showed that the unknown male profile was the son of a person who came forward to submit her DNA. The net was closing. The police executed a search warrant at the newborn baby screening unit in Brisbane and seized a heel prick blood sample, which was taken at birth. With DNA from the heel prick and the Cooktown volunteers, detectives identified a suspect, Matthew Ross White. His DNA matched DNA from the red twine found on the riverbank.
That's an incredible result by any stretch of the imagination. 200 samples obtained from a Cooktown population of about 3,000. The population of Cairns is about 150,000 and 220,000 in the wider area. Now that's roughly the population of Aberdeen in Scotland.
Or Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Right. It's not clear, though, whether they focused on a smaller geographical area to find their volunteers. Again, though, maybe the people of Cooktown tend not to move far from the area where they were born.
So Matthew White used to live in Cooktown. He'd moved to Cairns, but his mother still lived in the Cooktown area. She'd volunteered her DNA. And I wonder if she was being a good citizen or if she did suspect something. Whatever her motive, she gave the police the breakthrough they needed. Her genetic fingerprint put the finger on her son. Speaking as a mother, that must have been so tough for her. How on earth do you come to terms with the sudden knowledge that the baby you carried and raised to manhood is a killer? It reminds me that so much collateral damage is caused by crimes of violence. Many more people are hurt than the immediate victims. Whole families are torn apart. The shockwaves rumble through the generations.
Matthew White was motivated by money. He wanted 20,000 Australian dollars to gain custody of his son. His plan, if you can call it a plan, was to abduct Donna Steele and hold her to ransom. White kind of remembered that Donna had something to do with the drug scene in Cooktown. So he'd kidnap her and then extort money from her underworld connections. And then he'd just sail off into the sunset. White bought some twine and a stocking to go over his head. He borrowed a mate's car, drove up to Cooktown and broke into Donna's home. Hiding under the bed, he saw her make a bowl of cornflakes, and walk into the bedroom. When she was level with the bed, White grabbed her ankles.
At this point, the plan went to pot. White intended to subdue Donna and tie her up, but he could not overpower her. She managed to rip the stocking off his head. We can only guess she recognised him. Matty White, is that you? So with his plan and his stocking mask in tatters, White decided to strangle Donna with the twine instead.
It takes great strength and determination to strangle another human being, even with a ligature. Donna Steele must have realised she was fighting for her life. White had her on her knees, but the twine wasn't up to the job. He looked around and, well, here's an extract from his police interview.
Head, piece of twine, piece of twine. That's when he used it. Strangle her, but at that point I wasn't planning on killing her. I just wanted to only get some control and tie her up. And the plan was to start with Donna. I knew where she lived and I knew no neighbours nearby. And the plan was to start with her and get other people. I didn't think she'd have lots of money or be selling the drugs, but I knew she was involved in it. And I knew she'd know who was selling. At this point, I was freaking out. But that was God's plan. This piece of twine that I had wasn't working. And we knocked all the stuff over, and there was a scarf. And ended up grabbing this silk scarf instead of the twine, and I started to strangle her with that.
And so the twine wasn't very effective, and you then used a scarf. What were you thinking when you used a scarf?
I was just panicking at that point. Just wanted to stop fighting. Yeah.
And what did you think would cause her to stop fighting?
I just kept... scarf.
Okay, so you kept pulling on the scarf. Explain to me why you think that would cause her to stop fighting.
I just wanted to get unconscious, stop her breathing.
Get her unconscious and stop her breathing, were what he said. And what you'd want to hear as a detective, I suppose, Jack?
Yes, and he clearly intended to kill her, if not with the twine, then certainly with the scarf. White then found time to wrap Donna's body in the bedclothes, drive to a bridge, and tip the bundle into the river, weighing it down with rocks. Months later, when the police caught up with him, White confessed immediately.
At Cairns Supreme Court, White initially pleaded not guilty to Donna Steele's murder. But he changed his plea on the second day. After all, the police had a video of him confessing to strangling Donna and dumping her body in a crocodile-infested river.
Here's a weird thing. The local paper reported that White's mother blew him a kiss and wished him happy birthday after she'd given her evidence. He blew a kiss back and called, "I love you, Mum." Hang on a second. It was her DNA that put him in the dock.
Like you say, you can choose your friends, but not your relations. The judge described White as egotistic, naive, and shallow. He sentenced him to life in prison, which in Queensland means no less than 20 years. That means White will be eligible for parole when he's just a few years older than his victim was when he strangled her.
Listening to White's confession, I'm struck by just how matter-of-fact he is. It's like he's not describing a crime at all. He sounds like a kid explaining how a football got kicked through a window. Is this kind of confession common in your experience, Jack?
Reasonably uncommon, particularly one as full and as frank a confession as Matthew White's. I think we mentioned in an earlier episode, in my experience, some people cannot themselves believe what they've done. They process it like it was some kind of bad dream. And when they do confess, it's almost like a release to them that they can tell someone.
He does sound like he's in a trance-like state. Sleepwalking, you might say.
Yeah, although it means he's sleepwalking to prison for a very long time.
I suppose, Pip, that makes Matthew White an unlikely psychopath.
I think so too. Although we don't have a psychological profile of his character and personality, the confession suggests a degree of empathy and remorse. He was a young man who gave the appearance of being bored and seeking a thrill, as much as the money he claimed was the motivation. Was there an element of impulsivity? It appears not. He planned the crime for some time and travelled some distance to commit it. It just went wrong. Irresponsibility? Yes, of course. But he panicked and the whole thing escalated. Were drugs a contributory factor? Apparently not. White wasn't on drugs. Neither was Donna Steele. Any connection between her and drug dealers was all in White's head. I think what we've got here is a bored loser who didn't think through the consequences of his actions.
I suppose on that count, being disorganised with a lack of long-term goals would tick a couple of boxes on the psychopath test, but Matthew White doesn't score enough points to qualify as a psycho.
No, he's what the judge said he was, egotistic, naive and shallow.
Well, that is the last of our three case studies into the forensic use of familial DNA. Now, of course, the use of DNA evidence throws up all kinds of ethical and legal issues. What are my rights regarding the gathering, use and retention of my biometric data?
There were multiple issues with the retention of DNA on the UK National Database until the Protection of Freedoms Act in 2012. This act allowed the police to retain fingerprint and DNA data indefinitely for most people convicted of a recordable crime. Those not charged or not found guilty must have their DNA data deleted within a specified period. DNA provided voluntarily for the purposes of an investigation should be destroyed after the investigation is complete.
So, if Jack arrests me on, say, suspicion of assault, my DNA and fingerprints will be taken. But if no action is brought, or the case goes to court and I'm acquitted, my biometric data must be destroyed, right?
Yep. That's right. They can keep your DNA for up to 3 years. Then, by law, it has to be destroyed.
Ah, provided you don't have any previous convictions. Then it can be retained indefinitely. For me, this UK legislation in 2012 had the right balance between people's freedoms and allowing the police to detect crime.
And with volunteers, it'll be different, I suppose, because somebody has asked for their DNA to be included in the national database.
Yeah, and quite right too. The individual should have the choice, shouldn't they? Matthew White's mother felt a moral duty to provide her DNA for a crime that she had no reason to believe was linked to her in any way.
Prior to the 2012 Act, The idea of expanding the database to cover the entire UK population had its supporters as well as its critics. It has currently been rejected for the moment by the UK government as impractical and problematic for civil liberties. Supporters included Lord Justice Sedley and some police officers. Tony Blair said in 2006 that he could see no reason why the DNA of everyone should not ultimately be kept on record. This view had its opponents. Pressure groups like Reclaim Your DNA and Gene Watch. Shami Chakrabarty, director of Liberty, said in 2007 that a database for every man, woman and child in the country was a chilling proposal, ripe for indignity, error and abuse.
Meanwhile, back in Australia, New South Wales police have launched a DNA collection programme in the hope of finding answers to the 769 long-term missing person cases. Apparently, they have approximately 330 cases of unidentified bodies or human remains. Due to how old the missing person cases are, investigators say there is limited opportunity to obtain the DNA of the missing person, which is why they've now turned to familial DNA. Acting Assistant Commissioner Darren Bennett said, and I quote, "The objective now is to collect familial DNA from the relatives of missing persons across the country to facilitate further inquiries and in the hopes of matching these samples, locate loved ones, and provide answers to families."
We can't conclude a series about familial DNA without mentioning the famous case of the Isdalen woman. And Jack, I know this is a real favourite of yours.
Yes. In a nutshell, the story centres on the discovery of the charred remains of an unidentified woman in a remote valley near Bergen in Norway. Mitochondrial DNA revealed that her mother was of European descent. Isotopes from her teeth showed she grew up on the French border close to Belgium. But that is the tip of the iceberg. Armchair investigators, and a few serious ones, I should add, are completely absorbed by the mystery of the Isdalen woman.
So, was she murdered? And if so, who killed her? And why? I've always fancied a trip to Norway. Maybe we should go and check it out.
Psycho killer at the Arctic Circle certainly has a ring to it.
Thanks to the Cairns Post and news.com.au for the clips in this podcast. There's a link on our website to the video of Matthew White's confession. Just head on over to psycho-killer.co.
Now, it's time for me and Pip and Jack to say goodbye. We'll see you again soon on the dark side for another Psycho Killer shocking true crime story.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.